This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, it's a joy to welcome to Joy on Paper an author who is quite literally a man of my dreams. I have dreamt about Mike Resnick many times, and a few times he's actually kept me up in the middle of the night as I'm reading his books. But I have dreamt that I was like Raquel Welch, and I was miniaturized, and I could just jump right into the Proteus, like in that wonderful movie, Fantastic Voyage, and circle around and travel around inside Mike's brain, which I love. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Patsy. I'm flattered beyond belief.
Well, you know, I think that would be truly a fantastic voyage to travel around in that brain of yours. It is amazing.
Well, I've lived with it for a long time, so I think it's a little less amazing than you.
No, I can. You know, you have so many ideas. You have so many. You go to so many different places, and in that head of yours, you know. Back in time, up to the future, you know, it's amazing, and I'm sure it's like a, you know, it would be such a dramatic thing. You don't have little gray cells; you have all sorts of multicolored cells in there, I think.
Well, when all is said and done, you know, all of fiction, including science fiction, has got to be about people.
That's true, and you, as a matter of fact, that one of the things it's so funny. I think of you often, but it was about a month ago. I was watching a rerun of Castle, and they had they were doing something about vampires, and I came up. All I could remember was that line of yours. I knew a real live vampire. His name was Herbie Miller.
And yeah, that was the opening to the first Lucifer Jones book.
It is. I mean, it's so memorable. And when, you know, when you can create something that is that memorable for a reader, and I love the Lucifer Jones books. And
well, there's a new one coming out. I just got the Bound Galleys. I'll be happy to send them to you.
Wow. Oh, I didn't realize that. Wow. Wow. Because because some of the lines in there, and I went back and I had to pull it out because I don't know. It's just wonderful. And so you wrote a new one?
It's called Voyages.
Wow.
And I'm not sure quite when it comes out. Either November, December, maybe January.
Well, you have, you know.
Listen. But as I say, I've got the Bound Galleys, and there don't seem to be any errors in them. I'll be happy to send you a copy.
Oh, I would love it, because Lucifer Jones, he is a fantastic character.
He's more fun to write than all the stuff that wins me awards.
Well, you can tell. I mean, when you're reading, they're so funny. The stories are so funny, and it just and memorable, as I said, and obviously you've just developed a love for this character.
Well, it's a parody of every bad pulp story and B movie I've ever seen. And you don't run out of material like that. You know, just turn on your TV at 11 at night, you'll find something worth parodying.
And so when you first came out with it, that's quite a few years ago, you first came out with the idea, and explain a little bit how Lucifer Jones, I just the name and who he is.
All right, what happened was back in the early 80s, I was trading videotapes with a number of friends in different towns, and one of them dropped me a note that H. Rider Haggard, with Ursula Andress, was going to be on in a night or two, and they wondered if I'd tape it for them. And back then, everybody knew Betamax was the best system, and tapes only went 2 hours. So I checked my Malton guide, and the film was in like an hour and 53 minutes, which meant I couldn't just put it on, recorded commercials and all. It was going to cut out the last part of the movie if I did that. So I had to sit down with the clicker in my hand and cut out the commercials as they came on. And about 15 minutes into this movie, that's my wife, comes into the room and said, you know, if they were having a Marx Brothers festival, and I was laughing that hard, why didn't I tell her? And I was saying, no, I was watching maybe the worst movie ever made, and it was hilarious. And I was thinking, you know, if they could be that funny by accident, what could I do on purpose? So that night, I started outlining a novel that would make fun of every really dumb African story and magazine I had read. There's a British nobleman hiding from his creditors, living with a tribe of apes. That was Tarzan. And I did that with a number of other things. And Lucifer Jones came out, and it was very, very popular. And since the whole thing was set entirely in Africa, at the end of the book, the various African governments get together and forbid them ever from coming back to that continent. So that gave me a theme for each of the next few books. In China, it was, or not in China, in the second book, it was done in Asia. At the end of that, he's kicked off of Asia. In the third book, Europe, same thing. And the fourth book was South America. The fifth one, which I just, the one I'm telling you about, is called Voyages, and it's 10 or 12 episodes as he is island hopping across the Pacific to get to Australia, the only country that will tolerate his presence at this moment. And as he crosses the Pacific, he meets King and Mrs. Kong, a very unhappy couple, weigh about 17,000 pounds each, and any other things I could think of to parody.
Well, I think, you know, the Honorable Right Reverend Dr. Lucifer Jones is a fantastic character.
Well, I thank you very much. He's been great fun to write. I've been writing him now for 25 years, along with all the stuff, as I say, that brings in more money and wins awards. He's the one I like. I keep going back to.
Well, you've developed a voice for him, that's for sure. And when I say voice, it's the way he talks. You know,
his means of expressing himself owes an awful lot to Pogo Possum.
Yeah, it's so much. As I said, it's so much fun to read, and I think actually, you know, because they are short, sort of standalone stories, they're ideal for today's readers who have like limited time, whether they're on the, you know, on the subway or a coffee break. I think they're just ideal way for writers, for readers to get into reading really well-written work.
Well, I thank you. Every award I've won a ton of them. Almost all of them have been for short fiction of different lengths. I've not won that many for novels, and maybe it's that I agree with you, so I put a little more effort into the short stories.
Well, it's true that, you know, I told you last time when you were on, I could not devote time to telling everyone about all of your awards because, I mean, you have won so many. And I just discovered that somebody's done a bibliography of your work, and like the bibliography is 600 pages or something like that.
I think it's the second edition of it is out, and I think it's 700 pages.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, just think.
I like to write. What can I say?
What can I say?
And also, at this age, I don't know how else I'd make a living, but I love writing.
Well, that's clear, and I hope that people will read, you know, these wonderful Lucifer Jones series, because I think they're just amazing. And I, you know, we always, of course, talk about your science fiction work, and it's just so nice to be able to mention this to people who haven't tried that, because You know, I have a lot of listeners who are love science fiction, and I have quite a few writers who are listen to me all the time because they are working on science fiction. And as a matter of fact, from the last program you were on, you inspired some, and I have been hearing from them, and I have two young writers who are just like, I mean, they are now your biggest fans, and they just have learned so much from reading your books. And recently we had a wonderful event here. We have in this area so many wonderful writers, local writers. And so I help to inspire what we call here the Miami Avenue Book Nook, where local writers get to showcase their works. And so it's fun now that I can meet some of these young writers who have been inspired by you.
Well, that's very, very comforting to know that I'm inspiring people. Maybe I can help your younger writers a little bit. I'm editing a bi-monthly magazine called Galaxy's Edge, and we specialize in new and newer writers. If anybody out there has got a short story, and it must be officially a short story, under 7,500 words, and preferably I'd like to see them under 5,000, all you have to do is email it to me, and I'll get around to reading it.
Wow, that's a fantastic offer. Absolutely. Okay.
And if I can give you the email address over the air, or else you're on Facebook.
Well, give it over
there,
the air.
Just message me on Facebook, and I'll send you everything you need to know.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's wonderful for these writers to know, because I know that you have worked and you've collaborated with some young writers. And and it's, you know, really wonderful.
They've been dubbed my writer children.
Well, I know,
not by me, but I do everything I can to help beginners, because the field has been exceptionally good to me over the last half century, and I can't pay back. Everybody who helped me is dead or rich or both, so I pay forward.
Well, that's lovely. I know I read one of the books that you collaborated with a young writer, Tina Gower.
Oh, yeah.
And I really enjoyed this book, and I was wondering how does it work when you collaborate with somebody, with one of these young writers, and you work with them to put this book together?
Well, when I do it with one of the young writers, by and large, I make the sale. In this field, I sell before I write. So I make the sale based on a plot. And then I had Tina do the first half of the book, and I did the second half, and I edited her half, and don't think I changed 10 words, and then it went off for sale.
I'm sure she must have been so thrilled to have that opportunity to work with you and really set her career moving ahead.
Yeah. Well, she's a girl who has really done her groundwork. She won the $5,000 Gold Pen Award from Writers of the Future. She then won something called the Daphne du Maurier Award. And finally, she won the Romance Writers of America Award. These are all for beginners, but that's a lot of people seem to agree that she's got a lot of talent.
Absolutely. Well, it's a lovely little book, and with all of your books, of course, all of your books are so much fun to read. And I'm just, as I said, when you do this with a young writer, I think it's an amazing gift to them.
Well, the thing with this one was, this was basically, she mentioned an interesting fact to me, and we came up with a book out of it. The fact was that there were a number of biblical scholars who think that the four letters above Jesus' head, which you've seen in every rendition of him on the cross, were not I-N-R-I, but I-N-B-I. And the difference is, one translates as King of the Jews, the I-N-B-I translates as King of the World. And the second she mentioned that, I said, you know, wouldn't it be interesting if there was a King of the Universe somewhere, and especially if he wasn't being crucified on this planet? And that was the basis for the book we came up with.
And you ran with it, and it really turned out so nicely.
Yeah, and as I say, over the years I've collaborated, I believe my I can't remember them all, but my bibliographer tells me I've collaborated with 55 people. Some are just friends, and it's fun to do. Others, as I say, are newcomers, probably half of them, that I'm helping get into print. And I collaborate from them. I've bought from them for my anthologies for years. And now I found a wonderful publisher. His name is Shahid Mahmood, and he is Ark Manor Publishing. And he is the guy I talked into starting this magazine and this line of books that we were discussing. Galaxy's Edge exists to help beginners. Now, the problem is if they were all beginners, we'd go broke because there's not a name with any draw on the cover. So what I do is I buy 4 reprints per issue from major, major names that I can put on the cover. I mean, like last month's issue had George R. R. Martin, Robert Silverberg, Nancy Kress, and Robert Sawyer. And with those names on the cover, we're going to sell, and then I can buy 7 or 8 brand new stories to go with these 4 reprints by the big names. And that's what Galaxy's Edge has been doing for 4 years now. Everybody predicted it would bomb, and of course it's doing just fine. The line of books, and that was one of the ones, the one I did with Tina Gower that we were talking about, is called Stellar Guild. And again, it's to help beginners, and what it is a major, major writer, whether it's Larry Niven or Mercedes Lackey or Kevin Anderson, will write a novella, and a beginner of their choice, not mine, that they work with, will write a novella as well that is either a sequel, a prequel, or at least set in the same future and universe, and together that comes to a novel, and it helps a beginner so much more to share cover credit with a Larry Niven or a Harry Turtledove or me than it does to sell 2 or 3 stories on their own. So again, this line was created expressly to help beginners.
Well, I think it's fantastic. It's a wonderful gift you're giving them because, as you said, it's such a hard business to get into. Just to get published is so difficult, and that you're giving these young writers, even if they're not young, but they're new writers, the opportunity to work with you, with all of you talented people. It's fantastic.
Well, it goes back, about 20 years. I was doing a column for a magazine, regular monthly or bi-monthly magazine, I can't remember which now, in which I would answer beginners' questions about how the field works. And one of them said, this is maybe in the 1980s, what are the odds of coming out of the slush pile for a new writer? I didn't know, so I called the editors. And Gardner Dojois, who was editing Asimov's at the time, said they get about 1,000 slush stories a month. And I said, how many do you buy in the course of a year? He said, 3 or 4, which meant the odds are like 3,000 to 1 against a beginner getting into print there. And I called Christine Catherine Rush, who at the time was editing the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. The odds were much better there, only about 700 to 1 against. And when I heard that, I realized that, I was dead lucky, and so was everybody else who ever broke into print. Maybe I could make it a little easier for the next generation. So I've been doing my best ever since.
Well, I as I said, I think it's a fantastic thing, and I'm so happy to be able to tell people about this and to promote it, because, you know, what you're doing with Galaxy's Edge is a gift to writers and a gift to readers, because I think there are, as I said, so many readers now who they don't have time for a long book. And also, you know, we have the problem now of people not being able to concentrate for long lengths of time. You know, some people can't concentrate at all. But I do think that now with the ability for them to read these on their devices, you know, on the train, on the plane, hopefully not in the car. Of course, maybe in the future they're going to be able to do that with all these ideas of the future car with no driver. They can sit there and read these shorter works and have that pleasure of that really you only get through reading. It is not something that happens by watching television.
I agree. And between you and me, I can't wait for a driverless car. Nothing's more boring than being on the road for 4 or 5 hours and not being able to read or do anything except keep your eye ahead of you.
Well, I have to take a quick break, but when I come back, I want to talk to you about two things. One, I want to talk to you about, well, about Birthright and the
sure.
Book of Man, you know, of man, the whole thing, how it started, and then a few other things. Okay, so
sure.
Hold on, and
yeah.
We'll talk about your brain. Okay, we'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Looking for a good book? Then get over to Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. Check out the latest books from local authors like Angela Hunt, who wrote the book for the film Risen, or Bonsu Brenvick, whose books preserve the memories of the Bellevue Biltmore Hotel. What do you enjoy reading? A thriller? A romance? How about a mystery or a sci-fi? At the Book Nook, you'll find it all. Remember, one of the joys of life is to read. Located in Indian Rocks Beach, look for the blue building with the mermaid on the side, on the corner of Miami Avenue and 2nd Street, two blocks south of the post office. Open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday, noon to 4. And don't forget, while you're there, check out Miami Avenue's great collection of Florida wines, local art, and fantastic gifts. Miami Avenue Book Nook, where you will be inspired to read.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my favorite author with a brilliant mind and a fantastic brain, which I would love to jump into, Mike Resnick. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Patsy.
Okay. Well, you know, I hear that you have been talking to Chinese film producers. Is that true?
Yes, I have. I don't know what's going to come of it, but I knew they flew all the way over to talk to me, so... They must have had something in mind.
Well, it's about time because you know you've had a lot of things optioned over the years, and you know it's nice you make money from options.
You make very very good money from options. You make even better money from movies, but you probably my own feeling is I'll be happy to sell anybody a movie, but it doesn't mean I ever have to go to a theater to watch it.
Well, you know I'm a screenwriter, so I've gone through this option routine many, many times, and I love options. They can option everything and never make it. You know,
I love options. Now, I think I have 9 things under option.
Well, you know, and it's nice when they renew it, and then you get money. But it would be nice once in a while to actually see the things on the screen.
I've actually been paid for 3 screenplays that have never been made.
I know. It's hard when you do this and you see it in your head and you can see it. You know, as a writer, you see it on the big screen all the time in your head. So there's
what I see are versions of the biggest science fiction things that People love because they're good entertainment, but when you think about them from a writer's point of view, most of them are pretty dumb.
Oh, yeah.
Star Wars. It was great fun, but when you think about it, they want to replace an emperor with a princess. How does this help the voter on the street?
Well,
or Star Trek. Left turn, Mr. Sulu. Well, yeah, if you have 11 years, we can do that.
Yeah, I know. I wish, you know, if somebody could actually take one of your books, I don't know. I think Seven Views of Olduvai, is that, I'm pronouncing it right?
Olduvai.
Olduvai.
Yeah.
The Olduvai Gorge. Wow, what a visual that would be.
Well, that's under option, but it's been under option for a long time. Nobody's rushing forward to make it.
And Kieran Yaga.
I think a lot of these guys option it just so nobody else will make it.
Well, that's true, too. I think they do that. But, hopefully you get together with a film company that has major, major money and will act and actually has some, well, I don't know, some conscience, some or something.
Well, I'll tell you what, anybody actually starts shooting one of these things, you'll be the first to know after me.
Yeah, as I said, because being a screenwriter myself, I see things so visually. Well, that's why I love, it was funny when I'm watching Castle and I suddenly get this vision of Lucifer Jones. I mean, you write so beautifully, so clearly and so descriptively that one gets into your books and one sees the characters and one visualizes so beautifully. So, of course, that's always the problem that no one can ever quite make it. That's why people should read, because it is fun to read.
Oh, I agree. And, the science has made it so much easier to read now. You don't have to be carrying a book around with you.
Exactly.
I have a Nook. It currently holds 2,600 books. It is 14 ounces. And it goes everywhere with me. And it's not even half full.
Well, and I love when I'm able to bring people to reading, people who haven't been reading for a while, or they unfortunately high school just ruins people so often from reading. They just don't read after that. They say, I've read, that's it, I'm not going to read, because they give such junky stuff. But boy,
I think if you were to take a vote among high school students, the least favorite book in the universe would probably be Silas Marner, followed by other so-called classics.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it's just, give them Lucifer Jones, and boy, they'll get interested.
That's not required reading, although one of my books is in a number of colleges, Kieran Yaga.
Oh, what, Kieran Yaga. I can see why.
It's in a number of literary courses, but it's also, I believe, in the University of Wisconsin. I might be wrong about that. Somewhere in Wisconsin. It's in the sociology course, even.
Well, it's a great book. It's why it's won so many awards, I think, not just in English, in every other language. You've won.
Yeah, it was a surprise to me. And it was an interesting thing to write. Have I mentioned how I came to write it?
No, go ahead and tell us.
Orson Scott Card, who's a friend, was putting together an anthology in the late 1980s. And he contacted me one day and said he wanted me to write for it. It was called Utopia, spelled Eutopia. And he gave me a couple of rules that had to be obeyed. One was that it had to be told by an insider who believed in a utopian society rather than some tourist who says, well, this is what I saw and went home. And the second was, these are all various terraformed planets, planetoids, each of which was trying to create its own utopia. So he was going to have utopias for communists, for thinking dolphins, for whatever. So I told him, yeah, I would be happy to do East Africa. And I handed it in to him at the London Worldcon in 1987 as I was on my way down to Kenya. And I saw so many things on that next Kenyan trip that I figured, I've only written the first chapter of a book. There's a lot more to be done with this. And I asked Orson's permission to double-dip the story, by which I mean to sell it to a magazine before the book came out. And he gave me permission, and it won me my first Hugo. And to this day, I get nightmares thinking about what would have happened if he hadn't given me permission, because to this day, the anthology that it was written for still hasn't come out.
Oh, wow.
That's been 29 years, I think.
Well, it is. It's a fantastic book, and of course about utopia. Oh, wow. You know, with all the... Sometimes I think your mind must just get overloaded with all the things happening in the world. Some of the things, you know, that you talk about in some of your stories, some of the things that might happen to mankind are happening to mankind. And I'm thinking, you have spent a lot of time thinking about the future.
A bit. I mean, you know, that's where I live every time I sit down at the keyboard.
So, you know, it's hard to imagine what is the world going to be like, you know, in the future.
Well, the trick is not necessarily to give you an accurate imagining of what the world will be like. It is to put my various people through their paces. And as I say, I write about people more than I write about anything else, and to give them challenges and then to give them conflicts.
Yes, you're not one.
Can't do the same one each time, so I've probably imagined a couple of hundred futures.
And characters from other planets.
Aliens are really, if you look at it, they're just creatures, or I won't even say creatures, beings with one or another human facet emphasized or de-emphasized. I mean, if they are not serving to show off some good or bad portion of humanity, what do you want them in the story for? I mean, you come to a real, true alien, you know, he probably inhales carbon dioxide, excretes bricks, and has no written language. I mean, why would you want to write about him? I mean, every one of the science fiction writers probably takes one shot at a real, true alien. And they're only worth one because we'll never understand them. We'll probably never be able to communicate with them. There's no reason why we would want to. Our aliens are metaphors of different facets of the human condition.
When you write, do you already know all of, let's talk about, for example, the seven views of Olduvai.
Yeah.
You already had all your characters worked out before you started writing?
Yes. I can't stare at a blank screen and wait for inspiration. I always know what I'm going to write when I sit down. I may not know every detail, but yeah, I know what the story's going to be, what the characters are.
And then, of course, in that one, you did exactly that. Each of the beings did have some special feature about them that they brought to this this story. Of course, they were coming from another planet. The beings were coming from another planet as archaeologists.
Alien archaeologists coming to find out what man was like when he was still alive.
It's a great story.
It's probably won me more awards around the world than any other. Quite possibly because it's not set either in America or in a future dominated by the most scientifically sophisticated race, whatever that may be. This is set in Olduvai Gorge, which is in Tanzania, and man is already extinct. These are a bunch of alien scientist trying to figure out what man was like and what drove him to extinction. So as such, it certainly plays more to a general worldwide audience than some of my stories do.
I can see that, and it you could be from any country, and it's something that you can imagine what would happen if beings came from another planet. So that's exactly it, that it's a universal type of appeal.
Yeah, if you have 1 minute, I can give you the genesis of that one.
Okay, absolutely. I'd love to hear it.
Carol and I are on yet another trip to Africa with a private guide, a driver. And we're in Botswana, and they see a spring hare, which is just a rabbit. And Carol, my wife, and the driver, you know, we come to a stop, and they just stare at it and look at it and look at it. And over the next hill, I know there's a herd of elephants. I can hear them. I can even smell them. But I can't get anybody interested in leaving the damned rabbit. And finally, I mutter, you know, who comes to Africa to see a rabbit? And the second the words left my mouth, I realized, with habitat destruction, the time may be 100 years from now when that's exactly what you come to Africa to see. And that was the genesis for the story. In the story, there is a safari diary from somebody about 200 years from now that actually the guy goes a little crazy with excitement because that's exactly what they see, is a rabbit.
Well, as I said, I love this story, and I think it's one that everybody should read because it captures, I think, something of the humanity of you know what's happening to us today, and we're thinking about, you know, what's going to happen to the future generations, and yet as you said in this story, the aliens, the archaeologists, each have some facet of character or personality that what are the ones that the ones who talk back and forth that oh, my mind went. The one who finished each other's sentences. I love that.
I think his name translates as he who feels.
Well, he who feels is the one is yeah the main the narrator who
yeah.
who really
okay
carries it through and I just. Again, with all he's fantastic. I thought that was a great device of having him being the narrator because he.
Okay. As for names,
I know, but
it's been 29 years.
Well, I forgive you because I'm my mind went blank for a moment there too. But I have it, and I have the book, of course, and I think it's a wonderful thing that. That's happening in this world, that we have this ability on the internet to buy all of your books. I don't know if everything's there, but mostly everything's there.
Mostly, if you just go over to, I don't know, Amazon should have most of them in paper. And if you look around, I'm sure any two or three major sources, you put them together and they'll have just about everything I've done in e-form, either Kindle or Nook.
So you were just at Worldcon?
Yeah, I was just at the Worldcon and the DragonCon and another little con. And we did three in a month. Now I got to get back to work. I'm way behind.
And how was your trip to Paris this summer?
That was really interesting. I hadn't been to France for a convention in about 12, 15 years. I go when I'm comped, and I don't go when I have to pay my way. And they comped me, and I met a couple of my publishers who I had not met before and a couple of my editors, and hopefully we did some business.
The French love science fiction.
I have a number of friends who French friends who correspond with me and do love science fiction. One of the interesting things is... And this goes not only for France, but anywhere else. One of the things most writers should really think about is making friends with their translators, because this is not the case in France, but in an awful lot of countries, you got a publisher who doesn't read that well. I mean, he knows this book sold well in the U.S., or this book was nominated for an award, or this or that, but he himself can't read them. He reads his own language, maybe one or two others, but your translator can come up to him and say, hey, this book I could do, that book would be a bother. I think half the time you sell overseas after your initial sale in any given country's market, you're doing it because your translator gets behind it and pushes it and explains to the publisher why this book will translate into something that his audience can understand, whereas this other book might not.
And, of course, talking about that, you know, I know that you've made a lot of money from your foreign rights, and that's an important thing that young writers who are about to, nowadays there are publishers. Of course, you have the major publishers, but you also have smaller publishers who offer writers contracts, and it's very important that a writer be careful what he signs, because you do not want to sign away your rights, just like, J.K. Rowling did not sign away any of her rights, and that's why she now has a whole big thing here in Orlando, because she didn't sign away her rights. So you have to be careful about that.
No, you got to keep your rights. You sell to North America. There's no way. It's very hard to say separate out Canadian. So you sell North American rights, but then you've got 110 other countries, and you've got gaming rights, and you've got movie rights, and you've got no end of things you can do when you sign your contracts intelligently or have an agent who knows what he's doing to argue the contracts for you.
And you have theme park rights. Who knew, you know?
Yeah. And, some of them kind of lay there. I can usually sell each book I do at least five or six times over the next few years overseas, never for as much as I sell it for in America, but it totals up. And then some books, they go crazy overseas. There's a book I did called Santiago that I have sold 34 times, only once to America.
And it's a great book.
Well, I'm glad you like it, and I like it too. And it was my best selling book, but 34, well,
what, 34 sales?
One was America, 33 countries, and then I sold gaming rights to it. It's a game, and I don't play them, but it's a game in England, a computer game.
So that's
and it's been under continuous option to Hollywood since 1989. They haven't made it, but if they had made it in 1989, I would have less money than I've had from collecting all these options.
Stardust Twin. That's the name of the character. Remember?
I honestly don't remember that.
Uh-huh.
I'll have to look at the story. It's, as I say, I wrote it 30 years ago.
The reason I remembered it, because it's funny, I actually stole the idea from you. Now, don't sue me. But
oh, wait a minute. Yeah, now I do. They were twins. They finished each other's sentences.
They finished each other's sentences.
Yeah.
And I'm writing a book, and I have two characters. And I wanted to, and this has nothing to do with science fiction. It's a historical book set in the 1875 in India. But I had two English characters, and I wanted to make them different from everybody else. And they're just minor bits. It's a minor bit, but I wanted to make it. And when I wrote them, I had in mind the Stardust twin who finished each other's sentences. And I have these two characters, two guys in who have arrived in India, and I have them finishing each other's sentences. So I owe that to you.
Well, there you go. Certainly welcome to it.
Yeah, I was like, why? I know this because I stole this idea because it's very nice. I like that. It's a makes it a different different dynamics when you have one character finishing the other character's sentences. Much like sometimes
my wife and I have been doing that for each other.
I was just going to say that.
Half a century now.
Much like my husband and I do the same thing, so we know what we're going to say, and that's why you know it's nice to talk to somebody else once in a while. And it's so nice to talk to you. And you know, as I said, it's your. Because I think, you know, I've read your books over the years and reread some of them many times. And it's funny, you know, where how something, and this was what I tell people, read, because then when your mind is so full of ideas and so full of this sort of memories that come from reading, that then it enhances. Like if you're going to watch television, who knew that I'm watching Castle? But I'm thinking of Mike Resnick, you know, and that's the kind of thing. I think it's great for your brain cells. You know, if you just watch, it's sort of like people who watch football over and over and over and over and over again. I think after a while, you're just having those football cells. But if you read other books and even books about football or other subjects, it just, you know, keeps your mind active, which is important.
Oh, I fully agree. Of course, I've never done anything else in my life for a living, so I have to agree.
That's it. Well, and you keep your mind active, that's for sure. Well, I tell you, I am really, really excited about a new Lucifer Jones book, and I think it's just fantastic, and I want to thank you.
If the second we get off the air, you have my email address.
Of course.
Send me, email me your snail mail address, and I'll get it off to you today.
Absolutely, I will. And I want to, again, thank you for telling everyone about the Galaxy's Edge and all of the work that you do with young people. And I always tell everyone, I'm going to be speaking at a writer's event in October, and I always tell them if they want to learn how to write sci-fi, they have to read Mike Resnick because it's all there.
Well, I thank you for that. I got to say that all the newcomers aren't kids. I got a 70-year-old who just sold me his first story.
Well, that's true. I just taped an interview with somebody who's 70, and I've got a 90-year-old man coming on in a few weeks, and he just finished his first book. So,
well, you got a writer down in Florida who was the one who set me off on this path. Again, have you got a minute?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, his name's Nick DiCerio. And I was editing a book called Alternate Kennedys. That was not my choice. I was co-editing it with the guy who sold it. And it was, like most anthologies, by invitation only. I mean, they don't pay you enough to read 3,000 slush stories for one book that'll never have a sequel. And woman I had invited into the book was leading a workshop and read a story of Nick's that she thought would fit, so she told him to send it to me. And I should have sent it back with a reject and not even reading it because, it was not an open anthology. But I must have been in a bad mood that day, so I thought I'd read it and see just how dreadful it was. And by page 4, I knew nothing could keep it off the Hugo ballot. So I bought it, and indeed, nothing did keep it off the Hugo ballot. And he made the Campbell ballot for Best New Writer. And when I finally met him at a convention about 8 months later, I asked him, why did you send it to the anthology? Well, if you knew how good it was, the magazines at that time had about 3 times the circulation. You get more potential voters. And he said he had sent it to every magazine in the field and gotten a form reject from each of them. And all that meant to me was they should fire their slush readers, because it never got as far as an editor. No real editor could have turned it down. We became friends, correspondents, and about a year later, he sends me a novella, about 30,000 words, and said, he's been having the same problem with this one. Everybody's turned it down. He can't see what's wrong with it. Could I go over it and tell him how to fix it? And I went over it, and I thought, the only way you fix this is by submitting it as Robert Heinlein or Isaac Asimov. There wasn't a word that needed to be changed. And I knew somebody who I was sure would buy it. I sent it to them, and they did. And I thought, if we keep treating this kid this way, he's going to take that talent and go write espionage or mysteries and we'll have lost a major talent. So I started collaborating with him just to get him in print. We collaborated on 11 stories. A couple of them won prizes, but more to the point, we came out with a book of them, and he's had a career ever since. And it occurred to me, you know, if they're treating him like that, how many other beginners are getting in kind of short shrift? And that's when I started seeking out the very best beginners I could find and working with them, buying from them, collaborating with them, introducing them to editors and agents at conventions, all because initially this guy gave me a story that was too good to reject, and everybody had already rejected it.
Well, you have to send me Nick's email, and I'd love to talk to him, too.
Oh, I'd be happy to. He can't be that far away from you.
Okay. Well, thank you again so much, Mike, for being on today. And everybody can read about you on MikeResnick.com. And I know they can also order your books from there and read more about you and keep up with all of your activities. You're so busy all the time going to all of these events, but it's just wonderful. I appreciate you coming on today. And as
my pleasure.
You're in my mind.
Okay.
Okay. So take care and best to Carol.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Best to your husband.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Wow. Well, Mike is something special. As I said to several people who were asking me at the recent Book Nook, Miami Avenue Book Nook opening, there is really no other writer quite like Mike. One, of course, he's so multi-talented in both his comedy, we'll call it comedy writing, and his sci-fi writing. But the nicest thing is that he's just a good, warm, generous person. And I hope that some of you out there who are working on sci-fi, contact me, and I will put you in direct contact with Mike. And meanwhile, I just want to thank everyone for joining me today. I'm going to be having some very exciting guests coming up. Margaret Maron, another grandmaster, Mystery Writer of America grandmaster, is going to be on in October. And, of course, she is a fantastic mystery writer. And I'm so thrilled that she's going to be part of my whole grandmaster mystery writer group. And I hope eventually perhaps a grandmaster mystery writer tour where I can actually go and visit them and get some real FaceTime with them. So it's just wonderful to have all of these fantastic writers. And just meanwhile, find your joy and share it and have a great weekend. It's going to be, I hope, a nice weekend. And just enjoy yourself. That's the important thing. And join me next Tuesday right here on Tantalk Radio Networks. Tantalk Radio Networks stationed here on 106.1 and FM and AM 1340. Bye. Have a great weekend.